I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story. When Guardian journalist Peter Walker started researching his new book, The Miracle Pill, he was surprised to find out that we only began to really discover how good physical activity is for us in 1953, through observations of London bus workers.
London, the largest city in the world, has a splendid road service of passenger buses for the millions of people needing quick and comfortable transport from place to place.
That came down to the research of this incredibly brilliant but quite little known scientist called Dr. Jerry Morris.
Collecting fares and giving tickets is very important business. And when passengers help the conductor by having their money ready, his task is made easier.
And they worked out that bus conductors had half the rate of heart attacks than bus drivers.
The driver keeps a steady speed. He knows when he should reach the next stop, and drives so that he will be there right on time.
And it turned out simply because the bus conductors would run up and down about 500 or 600 flights of steps every shift, whereas obviously bus drivers would just be sat there. And that was all it took.
All it took to understand that exercise and physical activity is good for us, really good for us. And yet, nearly 7 decades after that study, and particularly now in the middle of a pandemic, we aren't doing anywhere near enough. Today, why too much sitting on the sofa or at our desks is shortening our lives. It's Thursday, the 22nd of April. Anushka Astana is editor-at-large for The Guardian and the host of Today in Focus podcast, where this episode first aired.
Peter Walker, you're a political journalist for The Guardian. How did you become interested in inactivity?
It's a slightly circuitous route. I mean, there's two reasons for it. One of which is a few years ago, I wrote a book about cycling. And part of that was looking into the problem of inactive lifestyles. In terms of just early deaths, the estimate is in the UK it kills 100,000 people a year. And I was completely shocked to find out quite how dangerous and how widespread inactive living was. But there's also a kind of personal reason too. It's fair to say that when I was growing up, I was a bit of a runt. I had asthma quite badly, and I kind of didn't have a lot of faith in my body. And, you know, as happens with a lot of people, you know, by the time I was 12 or 13 or 14, I kind of stopped doing most activity, most sport. I wouldn't even ride a bike or anything like that. And when I was about 22, for reasons I still can't quite fully understand, I decided to give up my job, which involved just sitting at a desk for 8 to 9 hours a day, to become a cycle courier. One of those people who kind of, in that largely pre-email period, would just pick up packages from an office and then cycle them around to another one as quickly as they could. It's fair to say the first few weeks, even the first few months, were quite difficult. But the transformation was enormous, you know, partly in just the way it looked and it felt. But the most important thing was this kind of assumption I'd always grown up with, that my body was kind of substandard and, you know, wouldn't really be much good if put to the test, was shed. And the mental effects were completely amazing. And it was such a transformative thing that that feeling has always kind of stayed with me.
And it's pretty shocking, that number of deaths you've just linked to inactivity. How inactive are we?
The short answer is very inactive. That's the same both in the UK and pretty much most countries around the world. And it seems to be getting worse. The broad figures for the UK is roughly 4 in 10 adults don't do enough activity to preserve their health in the long term.
But what do you mean, not enough? How much is enough?
In epidemiological terms, the recommendation for adults in the UK and in kind of most countries around the world is that you should aim for at least 150 minutes of moderate, at least, activity every week. So it's about 30 minutes a day, 5 times a week. And if you manage what's known as vigorous activity, like cycling quickly or jogging, then the recommendation goes down to 75 minutes.
But isn't there a bit of a paradox here? These days, people are going down to the gym, they're cycling, they're running, they're swimming, they're doing crazy British military fitness sessions in parks. I mean, exercise videos at home, whether it was Jane Fonda in the 80s. Or Joe Wicks today.
Today's workout is a 20-minute full-body workout.
You say we're inactive, but aren't we actually obsessed with exercise?
What has happened is that this kind of everyday integrated activity that people used to do without even thinking about it has gradually disappeared from the world, and it's been replaced by exercise, but as a kind of minority pursuit, almost a niche, slightly fetishized thing. And so activity levels have just dropped and dropped and dropped. And some of the statistics are completely astonishing. There's a study about how long people walk at any pace. This is a Department for Transport one. And it said in the last year, how often had they walked continuously for at least 20 minutes? And about one in five people basically said they never did that. So they never, ever walk for more than 20 minutes at a time. It's important to say early that this isn't because of a mass outbreak of like laziness in Britain or around the world. It's because the built environment in which we live has changed so much to make it difficult to do that kind of thing. There's two kind of technical public health terms I'll introduce. Exercise takes place in what epidemiologists call discretionary time. You know, basically, if you're at the gym, that's time you could have otherwise have been, if not working, then hanging out with loved ones or, you know, going for a drink. Whereas something which is your everyday routine is what's known as incidental activity. This is activity that takes place as part of your normal life.
How does this all compare to lifestyles in the past? And have we made life too comfortable for ourselves?
The thing to stress is that you don't necessarily want to go back to the old ways of having to, you know, chop wood if you want to be warm or to cook anything, or for women have to do this endless drudgery of like hand washing and rug beating and things like that. It's just that as everyday movement has diminished around us over the decades, nothing has really taken its place.
That's at Earl's Court, where the covers come off the brand new roadsters at the motor show.
A lot of it has come from transport, because car use has not only become, you know, the kind of default way for most British people and in lots of other countries, most people to get around, but it's often the case for a single, you know, able-bodied person going a fairly laughably small distance.
And ladies, perhaps for the first time, the choice is yours. If hubby doesn't want to give up those pleasant pints, you're going to do a lot of driving.
So it's not a question of returning to the past, it's a question of trying to find creative ways to integrate activity back into your life.
Let's delve into the science a bit. Why is activity good for us? What happens to our bodies when we're active?
It's a quite complicated kind of biological process. Basically, what someone explained to me is that having a kind of very, very functioning muscular and cardiovascular system takes quite a lot of bodily effort. So if you don't do it for quite a long time, your body just thinks to itself, well, sod it, I'm not going to bother. If someone gets a sedentary job and spends every evening sat down in front of TV in their 20s, they might not feel the consequences till their 40s or 50s, but these can be quite a number. It makes you much more likely to get diabetes type 2, high blood pressure, poor cardiovascular health, heart disease. Some types of cancer are very strongly linked to inactive living. And in the longer term, it can make your bones weaker, make you more likely to get arthritis and things like that.
A sedentary lifestyle is worse for your health than smoking, diabetes or heart disease, according to the new study from Cleveland Clinic.
This is a new report from the British Heart Foundation, and it suggests that 20 million Brits are physically inactive.
The American Heart Association is out with a new warning on the dangers of too much sitting.
In terms of the way it affects, you know, society, modern medicine is really, really good. And obviously, this is a great thing, keeping people alive for longer. But they're staying alive with often into later life. This quite complicated and incredibly expensive to treat series of interlinked issues. So whether it's diabetes and high blood pressure or a type of cancer. And one of the things I did for the book was I spent a day at the local accident and emergency department near where I live. This was just pre-COVID. And I spoke to two consultants in general medicine who basically oversee the kind of mass of people who come in. And I asked them, you know, what percentage of people who you get admitted have conditions which are connected to or at least exacerbated by inactive living? You know, one of them thought for a bit and he thought about 40 to 50%. And the other doctor said that he actually couldn't think of a single patient he had where inactivity wasn't a factor. And if you talk to public health experts, they basically say that the way things are going, within a few decades, the NHS as a free at point of service public health service will not be viable.
All of this sounds extremely worrying. But one thing I just want to make clear, because actually we don't talk about inactivity that much, but that is what you mean. You're not talking about obesity and the link between them?
I do mention obesity. I have a chapter about obesity in the book. And obesity is also a public health crisis. It connects with inactivity, but it's not the same thing. If you're inactive, then you're more likely to be overweight too. But pretty much every piece of evidence shows that even if you are overweight, then being active will improve your health outcomes, even if it doesn't necessarily mean you lose weight.
New research into what really makes a difference to death rates has shown that stepping up exercise is the most important factor, and being fit can matter even more than not being fat.
And that's one of the kind of most exciting things about activity science, that it always used to be this mantra you had to do at least 15 or 20 minutes. Whereas now, even relatively moderate amounts for 10 minutes at a time will pretty much always do your body good.
But it is still important to lose weight, isn't it? And isn't one of the issues here that the most effective way to lose weight, or at least this is what I find, is eating less rather than being active? So whilst, of course, I'm convinced that it's good to be active, it's not necessarily the path to being thinner.
No, it's not. Losing weight purely through activity is incredibly difficult. And perhaps the favourite academic study that I read was one that took place in Bulgaria in 1982. And it's a slightly sinister sounding one where scientists took a group of women who were overweight and put them through basically this health camp of exercises. And they all lost quite a lot of weight. But I'll read you what they had to do every day, which shows how much effort you have to do. So they ate normal calories, the same as they did before. But the exercise program lasted 10 hours. Every day, they had to do 50 minutes of gymnastics, an hour of standing exercises, an hour of gymnastics using apparatus, 2 hours of what's called walks and long distance races, 3 hours of sports and athletic games, and in the end, an hour of what's worryingly called therapeutic dances. They also did individual exercises, including swimming, tennis, and there's also a weekly walking tour, which began at 20 kilometres, which went up by 5 kilometres every week. So they found that even though they lost a lot of weight, they expended 3,700 calories a day, which is more than a professional footballer normally does. So it is possible, but unless you've got access to a kind of, you know, Bulgarian health stroke punishment camp circa 1982, it's not easy. You know, if you really, really want to lose weight, then activity is good, but you also need to think about your diet.
But if activity doesn't necessarily help you lose weight, does that mean it's hard to motivate people to do it?
So I think the really, really important message is almost to separate the two things out. There's a lot of stigma connected to activity and weight, and a lot of research that shows that people who are overweight don't want to do sport, don't want to go running, or don't want to join a gym, partly because, you know, they fear being mocked, but also because they think, well, you know, weight is the key thing. But study after study has shown that even if you don't lose the weight, then being active is really, really, really good for you. And there's even this incredibly controversial idea, which is slightly impolitely called fat and fit, which kind of has the theory that it's better for your health overall to be overweight to a certain extent and active rather than to be what's considered a normal weight or to be thin and to be inactive.
So Peter, I didn't have you down as a self-help guru. No, I mean, I sat next to you for a number of years, didn't I? In the political room for The Guardian. And I have to say, you weren't giving me tips day by day. But at the end of each chapter in your book, you do give out little tips. And I want to ask you about it. What is the most important advice for people? What do I need to do when I get up from this very sedentary interview?
Well, there's two things which I really, really took away from it. One of which is the idea of trying not to sit down too long. The risks of sitting down for very long periods are quite similar to those of being inactive. As part of the research for the book, I borrowed this kind of professional research grade activity tracker, and I managed to wear that for a few days doing my day job before COVID. And I was quite astonished to see how much in an average working day I sat down. It was easily 7 or 8 hours, which is far too much. So since then, I've got this quite cheap little rickety stand that I can put my laptop on, so I can stand up for an hour, sit down for an hour. You know, I don't always do that, but I sometimes do that. But the other thing I found too, I talked to all sorts of epidemiologists and other experts. At the end of every interview, I always ask them what they did. And I think the best piece of advice that I got was this guy called Professor Stephen Blair, who's now 84, but he actually still walks 15,000 steps a day. But his mantra is basically that it's all about what fits into your life. So I asked him, you know, what's the best type of activity? And he said something like, the type of activity that you'll do and keep on doing. If you have to I don't know, pick up the kids from school and it's maybe a mile away. If you can walk there in a safe way, then 2 or 3 days a week, do that, you know, ditch the car. Basically, whatever doesn't feel like an effort, it has to be something that fits into your everyday life.
And of course, this is individual responsibility, but it's clearly about much more than that. It's about public policy. It's about town planning. It's about what you are encouraged to do when you're at work. It's about architecture. How can things like that be used to increase activity?
I think this is an incredibly important point. It's one I really, really want to get home to people. If anyone listening to this is thinking, oh my goodness, I'm not very active, you know, I feel kind of guilt or shame. You know, ultimately, obviously, how active we are is our responsibility, but it's not necessarily our fault, because we're living in a world where activity is made really, really difficult. It is really, really, really important that the built environment we live in, both buildings and the way we get around between places, is redesigned to make it easier. At the most straightforward way, that can mean, you know, walking, cycling being made easier, whether it's bike lanes or slower car speeds.
My name is Jan Gehl. I'm an architect, and I have worked throughout my professional career with what we call humanistic city planning.
One of the most interesting people I talked to for the book was this Danish architect and planner called Jan Gehl. And he was basically the first person back in the 60s and 70s who started to say, well, why are we designing cities around cars? Why are we having these kind of unfriendly buildings with six-lane motorways between them? And he wanted to go back to this idea of cities as a place where people can like naturally mingle and walking or cycling becomes the kind of obvious thing. And it's fair to say that more or less any city which has had his kind of work on it will be a nicer place to live.
Copenhagen is the first city in the world who actually systematically have started to put restrictions to automobiles in the city. When last heard of, it's 41% of everybody who go by bicycle to work or studies in Copenhagen.
But it also goes into architecture too. There is the beginnings of this movement in architecture to get people to move around more. So, for example, one of the people I talked to was helping to design the Google headquarters, their massive, enormous Californian HQ. And one of the things that they decided to do was that all the workspaces are going to be on the first floor, but all the toilets, apart from the accessible toilets, are going to be on the ground floor. And the stairways are kind of very obvious and, you know, filled with light and nice to use. So the idea is that every time someone wants to go to the loo, they have to get up, walk down a flight of stairs and actually move. And it's all this kind of nudge stuff that you can do, but it requires central effort, really, for people to think about this.
And if it's not personal responsibility, then that sounds like it's something that will fit very neatly into your day job as a political reporter. What do politicians need to be doing about this?
Politicians need to take this seriously as an issue. Obesity is now kind of in some ways being tackled. The kind of very difficult thing is it needs concerted central government action over a long, long time. So partly it needs to be a focus on active living, but you also need to allow cities to kind of be redesigned in a way that makes things like walking and cycling a much more obvious thing to do. And there's so many changes that it becomes quite politically tricky. Everybody, I think, now recognises that inactivity is an issue, and some of them even know quite how bad a problem it is. But we're not quite yet at the stage of doing something about it.
What about Boris Johnson's post-COVID revelations that he needs to lose weight and get fit?
The reason I had such a nasty experience with the disease is that although I was superficially in the pink of health when I caught it, I had a very common underlying condition. My friends, I was too fat.
Could that influence policy?
It could do, and there's certainly people inside Number 10 who understand it. Johnson has gone with this idea of a war against obesity, which is, you know, obviously a good thing, but it's probably the trickier of the two issues to tackle, because losing weight is much more difficult than being active. I'd like to think that public health experts will have a word with him and say, perhaps you should be thinking about activity too. But obviously, COVID is taking up everyone's effort at the moment, so I think this is something for the slightly longer term.
Coming up, what has the pandemic meant for our activity levels? Peter, you obviously wrote most of this book in lockdown. And one of the things that has happened is that we've all changed the way we live our lives. Obviously, some people are walking more and doing particular types of exercise more. But in general activity terms, the large increase in the numbers working from home has presumably made people more sedentary.
That is why people will only be allowed to leave their home for the following very limited purposes. Shopping for basic necessities as infrequently as possible. One form of exercise.
Is there a way to measure this overall, to measure what impact the pandemic has had on our activity levels?
But only where this is absolutely necessary and cannot be done from home. That's all.
Yes, there is. I mean, when lockdown first took place about a year ago, it did almost look as though people were being more active because suddenly all our parks were filled with people, you know, lifting weights and jogging and skipping. But a lot of the activity that people get is commuting or walking through offices or things like that. So research by Sport England did actually find that overall activity levels, both for adults and children, did overall drop.
And so there's clear negatives, but could COVID also be an opportunity in this area?
I think it could be. And, you know, only time will tell. But the weird thing is that when I talked to politicians before COVID about why there wasn't much work being done on getting people more active, this dreaded phrase nanny state would always come up. People would always say, oh, you know, we can't have the government interfering in people's lives. And I think it's fair to say that under COVID, the bar for what constitutes nanny statism has been raised by an awful lot. And you can't make a direct comparison between inactivity and COVID. But I do wonder if some politicians, having listened to epidemiologists, you know, over this period, will be thinking, well, maybe we could do it. Maybe people will accept it a bit more. But the converse could be that once, you know, coronavirus is a bit more stabilised, people will think, I never want to hear from a public health expert again in my life.
In some ways, this is a hard issue, isn't it? Because the impact of inactivity is not necessarily as tangible as other diseases. However, overall, the scale of the crisis is comparable to what COVID-19 has done to the UK and also to the world. Should we be treating this like a pandemic?
I think we should. I mean, it is a pandemic by any definition of the term. It's just a kind of long-term, normalised, unnoticed one. And I guess there's two issues here, one of which is the number of people who die early. It's about 100,000 people a year around the world. It's about 5.3 million. That's an awful lot. That's enough to justify it on its own. But weirdly, almost the deaths are, in political terms, the less pressing part of the matter. The thing that really should be getting politicians' attention focused is the fact that medical science is so good at keeping people alive into the longer term, but inactivity means they're much more likely to be unhealthy for quite a long period. And there was some research actually that showed a lot of people are unhealthy for up to a third of their lives. And this is something that for the NHS and for older people's care is not really viable. So, you know, politicians have to realise it's not a question of if they're going to act, it's just a question of when. This problem is not going to go away.
Peter Walker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm off for a walk.
And me.
A brisk one. That was Peter Walker, political correspondent at The Guardian and author of The Miracle Pill, Why a Sedentary World is Getting It Wrong. Do check it out. If you follow Peter, you'll know he knows a lot about cycling as well. And I'd also recommend his previous book, How Cycling Can Save the World. Do also follow all his reporting and that of our entire Westminster team at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design was by Paloma Kaufman. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Full Story Newsroom Edition will be back with you tomorrow.